Last class, we had spoken about Prabhupada being practical and down to earth. And one of the things that I'm trying to accomplish by talking about Prabhupada is not, as you can tell from the courses, not just that we're talking about what Prabhupada did, but we're also talking about, we're trying to understand what he did within a context that can be applicable to our own preaching, because all of us are representing Prabhupada. And to represent Prabhupada, we have to understand how he did things. We have to understand what he gave priority to. And we have to understand how he understood the application of Krishna consciousness. Because when you learn something from Shastra, there are sometimes different ways of applying it, and also sometimes there are different ways of understanding it. And so what I'm hoping to accomplish in these classes, in this series, is to understand how Prabhupada would apply something. And in the last class, we were focusing particularly on not being fanatical or sentimental in relation to Guru. But what also came out of that class was how Prabhupada was practical, and he wanted us to be practical, and he wanted us to be intelligent, and he didn't want us to be blind followers. So he wanted us to intelligently understand things. And at the same time, we have the principle of faith in the words of the Guru, being absolute. So we have absolute faith in Prabhupada's words. But sometimes Prabhupada would joke with the devotees and he would say things like, even I can cheat you, but Krishna will never cheat you. And I think Prabhupada was saying, you know, posing himself as an ordinary person, ordinary guru, could even fall down, could take advantage of you, but Krishna will never do that. So it was kind of a warning. Don't just follow blindly. Don't believe anything blindly. And Prabhupada would often talk about sentimentality. And what he meant by sentimentality was that you act based on a feeling, but that feeling is not backed up by Shastra, by Guru, or by Sadhu. So that's an important element. At the same time, feeling is also important in Krishna consciousness. So it's not that all our feelings are bad or all our feelings are wrong. Sometimes we feel things which are inspired by Krishna. But what Prabhupada wanted us to do was to make sure that what we're feeling, to check if it's genuine or if it's directed, if those feelings will direct us to Krishna, if those are feelings which are helpful. Because sometimes we'll feel things that aren't Krishna conscious, and sometimes you can't control your feelings. It's just how you feel. But it's not that every feeling necessarily is Krishna conscious. You know, like sometimes you may think you're being inspired. You may think that Krishna is speaking to you or giving you an inspiration, and that may be true. But if it's not in line with Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, then we shouldn't accept it that way. So there's a balance there. So Prabhupada wanted us to both be inspired, intuitive, guided by Krishna from within, and at the same time practical, and practical meaning here in this context, confirming our actions, our feelings with what's in Shastra or what Prabhupada has given us. So he really, when he used the word sentimentality, he meant sentiment or feeling which is not connected with Shastra, Guru, or Sadhu. It's just going with one's own whims, more or less. Because feeling is a more subtle aspect of the mind, thinking, feeling, and willing. So thinking can be whimsical, it's just as feeling can be whimsical also. But if the feeling inspires us in Krishna consciousness, then that's good. But we should be intelligently guided. That's the idea. You have philosophy, you have sentiment. They can go together. You have bhakti. Bhakti is of the heart. It can go together. But it has to be guided properly. And so it's nice to just consider how many books Prabhupada translated and ask yourself, why? Why so many books? Because at one point Prabhupada said, if you understand one verse of the Gita, that's all you need to be Krishna conscious. Another time he said that everything he wanted to tell us he put in the first canto of the Bhagavatam. So then the question arises, if that's the case, why would Prabhupada need to translate anything? Nectar of devotion, nectar of instruction, Isopanishad, Chaitanya Charitamrita. I think there are two reasons. One is the more we have to hear and chant about, the better. And the other, because Krishna consciousness is a great science, and the more we read and study, the more we learn and understand. So I think the fact that Prabhupada translated so many books is really a statement that Krishna consciousness is not just religious sentiment, but it's solid philosophy. I was reading the Bhagavatam on the airplane. I have the Bhagavatam on my iPod. You can actually get Prabhupada's books in from different companies, and you can get it for your phone, at least for the iPod, the iPad. So I was reading Bhagavatam, and I was having a realization. Because as I told you last week, I had been watching some Christian preachers. And it was interesting to contrast the things Prabhupada was saying in the Bhagavatam purports with what we hear Christian preachers saying. And a lot of what I was reading was about the structure of the universe, which is quite interesting. It's not something you find in the Bible, not to my knowledge. And so Bhagavatam was giving a description of creation of and the structure of the universe. And the reason is because the science of God contains all of Krishna's energy. So it can scientifically explain this world and the transcendental world. And so I was just thinking how you don't see that in Christianity, that they're interested in explaining much about the universe. So the Bible doesn't contain that information. But Bhagavatam does, because it's a science. And therefore, science is juxtaposed to whim or mere sentimentality. So it's a science of God realization. And so Prabhupada's presenting a science. And he wants us, therefore, to be knowledgeable, practical, and understand the science of self-realization or God realization. Prabhupada was very transcendental, but anyone who worked with Prabhupada saw very clearly and very quickly that he was extremely practical about material affairs. So that's part of being Krishna conscious, and I think Prabhupada was demonstrating that by his example and showing that a devotee, because he does Krishna's work, then he's attentive to everything involved in Krishna's work. And although he's transcendentally situated, he's present to the work he's doing. And when we were younger devotees, we were, for lack of a better word, pretty spaced out. Or I wouldn't say we were spaced out in the sense of incompetent. But I think we were spaced out in the sense of we didn't think attention to detail was important. Not that we couldn't be attentive. But we'd come from this hippie culture where many things that were important no longer became important to us. We didn't want to be involved in the trivia of material activity, or at least material activities we saw it we were involved in material activity, but not the forms of materialism of our parents. So we had a tendency to be spaced out, to just not care about those things. So when we became devotees, we had to manage an institution, so we had to care about those things. And Prabhupada had to work with us so that we would come down to earth, so to speak, because we had a tendency to just go off in bliss land and not want to deal with practical reality. So Prabhupada was never like that. He was able to be in both worlds at the same time. He could be very absorbed in preaching and very absorbed in Bhagavatam and very absorbed in his translation. At the same time, very grounded in terms of managing ISKCON, attentive to detail, careful that the philosophy was being received properly and transmitted by his disciples to the new devotees, intact as he had given it. So that's a good example. You know, because sometimes you might think a sadhu is aloof. He's so aloof, he's not really aware of what's going on the material level. And sometimes devotees would ask questions to Prabhupada and he would give an answer that seemed to indicate that Prabhupada wasn't really aware on the material level of the situation. So then sometimes devotees would reframe the question, thinking that Prabhupada didn't understand it. And in most cases, I would say in the majority of cases, the reality was the devotee didn't understand the answer. Prabhupada did understand it. He just understood it better than the devotees did. They thought they may have understood it and were explaining it to Prabhupada. And then Prabhupada would give his point of view on it. And in most cases, it was right on. Perfect understanding of the situation. So perfect sometimes that we thought he didn't really understand it. He understood it better than we did. So we sometimes had the idea of the sadhu maybe not understanding things well on the material level, and being a little bit aloof or even sometimes impractical. And that's why sometimes devotees, not often, they might have second-guess Prabhupada. When Prabhupada said, do it this way, or then they thought, no, Prabhupada doesn't understand. Now, in some cases, he may not have understood something that's done in America in a certain way. You know, devotees would explain it. But in many cases, most cases, he did understand. He just understood it better. And sometimes we thought, he's too much of a sadhu, he doesn't understand. And that is true for some people. Some people are a little too transcendental to manage things. But that wasn't the way Prabhupada was. And it's not really the way he wants us to be. So, in the same way, sometimes Prabhupada would ask a question like, how do you know I'm not cheating you? How do you know what I say is true? He always wanted us to use our intelligence to question. Sometimes they'd be having a class and then Prabhupada would make a point and then he would say, now discuss. And he would stop talking and to discuss amongst yourselves and there'd be a discussion going on. He wanted us to understand things very deeply. Discuss, talk about it. Understand it, explain it to others. He really didn't want us to accept Krishna consciousness without understanding it from a more practical and scientific perspective. Otherwise, what happens is it's if you don't understand it philosophically, then you may be performing Krishna consciousness because you're a pious person, but you won't really advance much. You won't really detach yourself because you won't understand the necessity of it or how to do it. So Prabhupada really wanted us to understand exactly what is Krishna consciousness, exactly how to practice it, and not just have our head in the clouds or just go with only it with our feelings. And that's why he was always preaching to us, and he translated so many books. So that was kind of the theme of the last class, Prabhupada's practicality, down to earth. And also, sometimes we saw Prabhupada very observant of things. Maybe we didn't think he would understand something, but he was always observing, he was always looking. I noticed that one time I had the opportunity to do Guru Puja to Prabhupada, to offer the Artik during Guru Puja. And he, during the kirtan, he was looking around a lot. When I was offering the Artik, I got the impression he was just looking at everything, just seeing how his movement was going, how the kirtan was going, how the devotees were doing. He was very, very attentive to what was going on. There are times when Prabhupada would point things out that were dirty or needed repair in Mayapur, Vrindavan. And then Prabhupada would say, "Am I the only one with eyes?" Like Prabhupada would see these things. So he was showing us that to be a sadhu doesn't mean to neglect the details of taking care of Krishna's service or Krishna's property. Am I the only one who has eyes? Why isn't everybody seeing it? Maybe we don't have eyes, or maybe we just didn't see the importance of it. But Prabhupada, there's a story even. There was Prabhupada, I think the way the story goes, there was a morning walk, and Prabhupada walked by a home and he saw that water was coming out of a spigot, and he went up and he turned it off and he said, "Krishna's energy is being wasted." One time someone had left a room in Mayapur and locked it, and Prabhupada walked by and he looked through the window and he saw, of course, that nobody was there, the door was locked, but the fan was on. And he said something like, "Who is that crazy person who left the fan on, but it's not in the room?" So he saw that as a huge waste of Krishna's energy. So he noticed these things. It was actually very upset that Krishna's energy is being wasted. So he wanted us to be like that. You know, there's another story. Prabhupada had a letter in Vrindavan. So Vrindavan's, it's a small place. You know, to go from one end of the Vrindavan town to the other by rickshaw might take you 15 minutes or so, or 20 minutes. So Prabhupada had to mail a letter, and he asked his servant, if he could find out the cost of postage and find out the cost of a rickshaw, because he could just deliver the letter by rickshaw. So the servant found out, and there was like a one rupee difference, very insignificant difference. And they were spending hundreds of thousands of dollars in the temple, in the Krishna Balaram temple, to build it at that time. And so they found out it was like a rupee cheaper to mail it. And Prabhupada said, "Then mail it." So it was amazing how conscious he was to not waste Krishna's money. Sometimes somebody didn't come to class, and then Prabhupada would look and see they're not there and say, "Where's so-and-so?" One time devotees stayed out late and many were sleeping through Mangalartik, and he woke them up. "Why aren't you at Mangalartik?" "Well, Prabhupada, we got back late. Sleep later. Go to Mangalartik." So he's very, very attentive to establish and maintain the principles of Krishna consciousness. So you could say his eyes were everywhere, he would see everything. So we should be like that. We should learn from Prabhupada like that. We should be very, very careful and attentive to detail. One of the things that I found is that whenever I worked with someone who had worked with Prabhupada, I'd always notice that they were very attentive to detail, because that's the way Prabhupada was. We don't want to make mistakes where Krishna's service can be jeopardized by doing something foolish, not being attentive to details. And I know some of us may have that nature, that we're not as attentive to details as others, and some of us may have the nature to be very attentive to details. But I'm just making the point that Prabhupada wanted us to be practical. He was practical, and he wanted us to be practical, and he liked devotees who were practical. He didn't like devotees who were irresponsible or spaced out. All the GBC men that Prabhupada worked with, or most of them, are very responsible people, practical, attentive to detail, and that's what Prabhupada liked. So, in the last class, we were talking about this in relation to choosing a guru, that it shouldn't be sentimental. And at the same time, we were talking about that the guru shouldn't, we should have a relationship which strengthens our devotional service. It shouldn't be a relationship that is artificial or overly sentimental. Overly sentimental in the sense that we were talking last week, where you don't function well in separation from your guru. You only function well in their presence. Now, certainly we all function well in the presence of our guru. That's natural, it's normal, we're inspired. And not only if we're his disciple, but all the devotees usually become inspired by senior devotees. So I never would say that's wrong. But you understand the principle that just to be inspired in their presence and not inspired otherwise is not at all Prabhupada's mood. Not at all. And again, if we go back to his books, then as you may know, Prabhupada said, if you want to know me, read my books. And when Prabhupada was asked, who will be your successor after you die? And Prabhupada said, I will never die, because I will live forever in my books. So Prabhupada's books were very important, because it's how we can maturely progress in Krishna consciousness. And one of the things that I noticed amongst many, many older devotees, that as they've gone through different stages of devotional service, they tell me how much they've become attached to reading Prabhupada's books. So it's not that we're not attached to reading books of our spiritual master or listening to lectures of our spiritual master, but a greater attachment starts developing as we progress in Krishna consciousness, a greater attachment to Prabhupada's books and hearing his lectures, morning walks, conversations. That also develops, increasing attachment. And then I believe that you understand your spiritual master better by understanding Prabhupada better, because your spiritual master is representing Prabhupada. And if you understand Prabhupada better, then you'll always understand the heart of your spiritual master. Let's say your spiritual master tells you to do something, and maybe there's a question in your mind about what he meant. But if you understand Prabhupada well, generally, then you'll be able to figure out the answer if you're confused. Because you'll know Prabhupada's mood, and you'll know that that's his mood. Or you'll know the philosophy, and then if there's a question, you'll understand through Prabhupada what the understanding is, and so then you won't be confused. So that's important, because your spiritual master is only representing what he's learned from Prabhupada. And he has no independent existence. He is simply a via media of Srila Prabhupada. And he's only trying to give you Prabhupada. At the same time, Prabhupada's accessible to you through his books and through serving his mission. So you have both things going on. You have access to Prabhupada directly and access through your spiritual master. So I've been asking or recommending to all the devotees to read the Prabhupada Lilamrita. And actually, I suggest you read every book that's ever written about Prabhupada. Harishari Prabhu has written, I don't know how many volumes, four or five or six. Bhurijan Prabhu has written a book. Guru Das has written a book. Actually, so many books. There's Prabhupada and Prabhupada in South Africa, Prabhupada in Germany. Lokanatha Maharaj has written a book about his dealings with Prabhupada. Now we have a new one by Jamuna. And as people write their books about Prabhupada and recollect him, I think Girashami has written something also. The more you read, the more you'll understand. And one of the nice things about these books is that you get a lot of behind the scenes Prabhupada. And so the public Prabhupada had a certain formality to it. It was Prabhupada, at least is the way I see it. I always saw Prabhupada in public as the perfect representative of Vyasa, that he was perfectly explaining the message of Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Bhakti Rasamrita, and he was perfectly representing the Bhakti Shastras, the different Bhakti books, as guru in disciplic succession. That is your seva, that is your service, that is your duty. But when I say behind the scenes, I mean in the day-to-day affairs of Prabhupada carrying out the preaching of Krishna consciousness. You can learn so much about what pure devotional service is, and you can learn so much about how, for lack of a better word, I would just say Prabhupada's mood. What, you know, like sometimes what maybe we see something going on in our movement or a devotee acting a certain way. And sometimes we might feel that this doesn't seem to be Prabhupada's mood, the way this devotee is dealing. But then how do you know what is Prabhupada's mood? In these books you find out more about the mood because you see Prabhupada dealing on a day-to-day basis in so many situations. And you learn how he acts, how he relates to people, what he values, what he deprecates, what he glorifies, what he appreciates, what he criticizes, who he chastises, what he corrects, how he corrects it. You get a really good understanding of what Prabhupada was giving and how he was giving it and what his vision is, how he's trying to accomplish it. So all these things are important for us. Because we're trying to embody what it is that Prabhupada wanted of us. So we want to be, you could say, a personification or an instrument of his will, a personification of his ideal for a devotee, for a disciple, for one who is a preacher, one who is a Brahmin. How did Prabhupada, what did he expect of us? How did he train us? These things are important. Sometimes you may not always know how Prabhupada trained his disciples. You may not know what he expected, but we should know. We should know how he trained and what he expected. A lot of younger devotees don't know, because unless they're trained, they won't know. So you may not always get the training, but I think if you read all these books, then you'll understand Prabhupada very clearly, very dearly. And another thing that I mentioned before, I don't know if all of you heard it, but I find listening to Prabhupada's morning walks to be very revealing and very empowering in terms of spreading Krishna consciousness. And you'll have to listen to the morning walks to understand what I'm saying. It's hard for me to exactly explain it, but those morning walks, they reveal Prabhupada in a different light than you see him in Bhagavatam classes. At least from my perspective, it reveals Prabhupada as the Sankirtan general. Because a lot of these morning walks are mock debates about what people believe, what people are thinking, what people are doing, and what people are saying, and Prabhupada's responding to them. So a lot of times he points out the defects in civilization and why they're defects and where those defects will take society And then he shows how Krishna consciousness solves that. So it's very inspiring, especially for preachers, to listen to those morning walks. And it also kind of gives you see Prabhupada's vision as a preacher through those morning walks. Because sometimes he'll talk about vision, or he'll talk about what we should do, how we should preach, who we should preach to, what our goals are, what we should accomplish. So it's for me, it's kind of like, it takes me right back to the time when Prabhupada was here, because when Prabhupada was here, we were all very, very revolutionary. We were spreading the movement, and it was expanding very rapidly, and so we really felt like we were changing the world. And when you go on a morning walk with Prabhupada, it's kind of like he's laying out the blueprints and the strategy for changing the world. And that's why I think that's a good way to explain it. I wasn't able to articulate it well. The blueprint and the strategy for changing the world, making the world Krishna conscious. You get a lot of that in the morning walks, and that's why they're so powerful. And it gives you that, it lets you see that side of Prabhupada, that general, that Sankirtan general, the preacher, the visionary who's come to make the whole world Krishna conscious. And that just broadens your vision so much. Like, we're all doing our little service. We're trying to, Dustin's in Las Vegas, they've got a house and some property, they're making that into a temple, he's doing his lounge program. Mexico, we're doing our preaching, getting ready to go in the corporate world, developing our websites. So it's a little bit provincial, it's local. But Prabhupada, he was about changing governments, things of that nature, about defeating scientists. If, for example, you expose scientists, if you could do that, then that right, that cuts the jugular vein of the scientific delusion that the whole world's in. So that could change society, change the world in a huge way. And that's how Prabhupada was thinking, you know, going for the jugular vein of materialism. And so those morning walks, that's what you get from you, from a lot of them, that's what you get, that the kind of mood of the revolutionary mood changing the world. And it's so nice to hear it, because it just broadens your vision. It makes you realize this is actually our goal. Like they say, when you do strategic planning, what your strategy is, what you really, you have to start with your goal. What is it we're doing? And so hearing the morning walks kind of reminds you what we're doing is we're trying to change human society. A lot of those morning walks probably would say things like, you know, they're going to hell, they have no knowledge, they're all fools. They'd be talking about scientists, Nobel laureates, and devotees would explain things that they said, and sometimes what they said was wrong, and Prabhupada would point it out. And he would say, just see how foolish they are. And it was so ironic, because these were Nobel laureates, or people of that, maybe not Nobel laureates, but people of that caliber. And he would point out the foolishness. And those kinds of things would just be very inspiring, because you'd realize that even the so-called intelligent people are foolish, and because they don't have Vedic conclusions. And compared to Prabhupada, they were very foolish. So that's my recommendation to you. I think you can. In India, we got all the audio on a couple of DVDs. And when I went to Mexico, I brought it, and I asked some devotees to copy it so that you could all download it, so it would be available to you. So we should get that. And then reading the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada said my purports are my devotional ecstasies. That means it's, the purports are a manifestation of his love of Krishna. So it's good that we all read Bhagavatam every day, because that also brings us closer to Prabhupada. When you read his books, you understand him better. You understand his heart. And one thing about Prabhupada's books is they're purposely repetitive. And Prabhupada might explain the same point in different ways, different angles of vision. Sometimes he'll explain the same point in the same way. And so by reading daily, then you start to understand very clearly Prabhupada. And one experience that I've had, it's quite interesting. I just had this experience a couple of days ago. It was really nice. I heard something that Prabhupada said, and it kind of summed up everything that I had been preaching. Not everything I had been preaching, but it summed up one of the main points of my preaching over the last few years. It summed it up in like one sentence. And when I heard it, I thought, yes, I was representing Prabhupada's teachings, I was representing what he wanted by making specific points over the last few years, you know, very essential, what I felt were essential points of philosophy. But I wasn't quoting Prabhupada, and it wasn't that I had read those things per se, but they were conclusions I had come to from general instructions that I heard from Prabhupada, and also my own realization. So when I heard the statement of Prabhupada, I thought, this is the importance of understanding Prabhupada's teachings. Because when you understand the essence of Prabhupada's teachings, then through your own general study and through your own realizations, you will come up with ideas which you feel are profound, deep, they're deep explorations of the philosophy, and you come up with it. And because you know Prabhupada, what you come up with will be essential teachings. So now you all want to know, what was it that Prabhupada said that was so, that got you thinking, oh, just see how, because I've understood, you know, I've read Prabhupada's books, I understand him. I was happy to see that Prabhupada was putting it in a more essential way than I was. So I'll tell you what he said. And then I think you'll understand how this relates to so much of what I teach. You want to hear what Prabhupada said? Are you still there? Awake, alive, and ready. I'm not awake, alive, and ready, but somehow I'm talking. I'm dancing a lot, and I'm tired. I'm not used to dancing so much. Okay, so Prabhupada was asked a very important question. He was saying, a devotee was asking, do sinful reactions or sinful activities of the past, do they prevent us from being Krishna conscious? Or do they hold us back in some way? So he was, I forget if he asked anything else, but the juxt of the question was, can something we've done in the past be a detriment, or more precisely, can that prevent us from being Krishna conscious? And Prabhupada gave a very nice answer, which was maybe a little different than some people might suspect, because some people might say, well, yes, your sinful activities are contaminating you, and so that's going to affect you. And Prabhupada said, bhakti is not caused or blocked by anything material. It is just your will and your desire, and by your will and desire, you get Krishna. And that's all that matters. That's all that's important. So he was saying, nothing is going to stop you in Krishna consciousness. It's only your desire. Isn't that nice? It's just up to us. It's just you. And you all know that I've been teaching varieties of that for so many years now. we were talking about that in the last class. Everybody says, give me your blessings. And I always think, well, you know, bless yourself. By your sincere efforts, you bless yourself. And then last week we read that purport, and Prabhupada said, by sincerely serving the spiritual master, you get his blessings. So you actually create the blessings. So, did you not hear what I just said? Did it go off right when I gave the answer? Now you may never get to hear the answer again. Wow. Prabhupada said that Krishna consciousness, you get Krishna consciousness. He said, it's because you, your desire, your willpower, your effort, it's all you. So your sinful activities can't prevent you. Your past can't prevent you. See, bhakti's not like that. It said, the mercy is there, it's just you. Your willpower, your desire, your effort, you get that mercy, it's always there. So, you all know that's what I've been teaching, right? And so, but I never heard Prabhupada just say it succinctly like that. I heard Prabhupada say various things, like you have to fly your own airplane, nobody can fly it for you, and talk about determination and so on. So, I would put all these things together, and I heard Prabhupada talk about being responsible and so forth. So I would, you know, put it all together, and I would always tell devotees, ultimately, it depends on you. So Prabhupada just said the same thing in a very succinct way. And when I heard it, I said, This is why it's so important to understand Prabhupada and his mood and his teachings, because then when you contemplate everything Prabhupada said and you contemplate your own life and your own experience and you read things that other people have said, you'll always come up with the right conclusion, because you'll know deep in your heart, it'll be in your blood, what is Prabhupada's mood. And that's very, very important. And you are all, now you who are listening to this, you are all what we would consider second generation. You're not disciples of Prabhupada. So in that sense, we can call you second generation, okay? And there's concern by the leadership that the second generation understand Prabhupada. Because when the first generation, meaning the Prabhupada disciples, are gone, then you are the next ones in line to represent Prabhupada. And of course, for us to understand Prabhupada is a little easier because we live with him. We lived in his ISKCON when he was alive. And so we saw how his ISKCON ran. So it's natural for us, you know, people, you know, you see something going on today and we can think, well, that never went on when Prabhupada was here. And then you can look at it, you can investigate it, you can think about it, is this what Prabhupada wanted? For you today, there may be things that have been going on ever since you joined ISKCON. So how would you think that maybe this isn't right? How would you think that maybe Prabhupada didn't want this? You need to learn. It's important. So you're the next generation who will represent Prabhupada. When all of us are gone, all of us who are telling you about Prabhupada, who are correcting you, we won't be around to tell you and correct you. So you'll have to know, because you'll have to give this to the third generation. And if you don't get it right, they certainly won't get it right, I don't think. Or they'll read Lilamrita and other books, but maybe they won't understand as clearly as they should, as they need to. So now, did you all hear? I think I explained it. Yeah. We have now in our movement what's called a, I think it's a succession committee or strategic planning for a succession. And what that means is how to turn over the management and the foundational aspects of ISKCON to the next generation so that they are well equipped to understand what Prabhupada wanted, what he didn't want, what his priorities were, and so forth. So I think I would say that responsibility really belongs to everyone, because as disciples of Prabhupada directly or as Siksha disciples, then it's our duty to understand him, understand his mission, and transmit that to everybody. So it's not that there aren't different moods in ISKCON with different devotees and different spiritual masters, but they all need to center around Prabhupada's mood, what he wanted, to be in alignment in general with what he wanted. So that's the idea. That's what Prabhupada wanted. And he gave us so many instructions. And oftentimes when people would ask Prabhupada questions that he had answered in his books or he had answered in his letters, he would say, "Why are you asking this? I've already answered this." So he expected us to know Krishna consciousness. There was even one morning walk, a devotee asked a question. And as was common on the morning walk, sometimes what would happen on the morning walks is devotees would have mock debates with Prabhupada and they would take the role of a scientist or a professor or scholar, and they would give the argument that the scholars or the professors or the scientists give. So one devotee presented an argument, some fallacy about Bhagavad Gita, and Prabhupada stopped and he said, I don't know what the question is, they say, you know, but let's say it's something like, I think he said something like the Bhagavad Gita is only 3,000 years old, or something about the dating of Bhagavad Gita. And Prabhupada stopped and said, "You don't know? You're asking this question, you don't know?" He chastised him for the question, but he was just doing mock debate, representing what people think. And Prabhupada just took it. "You don't know? You don't know Bhagavad Gita is 5,000 years old? You don't know Bhagavad Gita is eternal? Wasn't written, you know, it came down eternally, just spoken 5,000. You don't know these things? You're my student, you're my disciple, you don't know?" So he wanted us to know, for sure he wanted us to know. It was very important that we knew. And if we didn't, he was upset. So he wanted us to know his books. And if you just think about it, you know, somebody makes a present for you, you want to use it because that's how you show your affection. So Prabhupada wrote these books and we show our service to Prabhupada and our affection by reading them. And, of course, by following them. So, again, if you didn't hear the answer, again the answer was, "Can anything stop our bhakti?" And Prabhupada said, "No, it's only your desire is everything." In other words, he was saying, it's really in your hands. Of course, you need blessings. You need Sangha, you need the holy name, you need so many things. That's not what Prabhupada meant. He meant it's in your hands to take advantage of those. Your willpower, your desire, your determination, that's the only thing that can stop your bhakti. Your past sinful activities won't stop your bhakti. The only thing that will stop it is your lack of willpower. That was Prabhupada's point. And I was just making the point that because I've understood Prabhupada, I could come up with conclusions in my preaching that always I couldn't quote verbatim Prabhupada saying something that would exactly support what I'm saying. But when you understand Prabhupada's instructions, then you'll always say the right thing, even if you can't support it verbatim. At least I couldn't support it verbatim, but actually this quote now supports it verbatim. I'm just saying that I was happy to know that Prabhupada said this, and I, you know, through studying everything else he said, I made an assumption and came to a conclusion, which is basically what Prabhupada just said, that it depends on you. So Dustin is saying that I've noticed in the morning walks, Srila Prabhupada had interesting interactions with Indian gentlemen who had a different understanding of bhakti. Yeah, there's a story about that. He would argue with them. It's easy to get in arguments over religion in India, because there's a lot of people interested in religion, and there's a lot of books on religion and Vedas and so on that present different ideas, impersonal ideas, or Westerners cannot be Brahmins, deity is temporary, you worship it to focus on a form, but when you merge in Brahman you get rid of the deity, and all these kinds of things. So people have a lot of ideas in India, and they may have grown up with these ideas, and they may accept these ideas as fact. And a lot of these ideas are completely wrong. They're not backed up by any scripture at all. It's just, it's kind of like a traditional misunderstanding that's been passed down. So there's a man named Dr. Patel, and sometimes he would argue with Prabhupada about these topics. And then the arguments were getting heated and constant. And so one day Prabhupada said, on our morning walks now, we will just read Krishna book, because I don't want to have any more arguments with Dr. Patel. It's not good. So we'll just walk and we'll read Krishna book. And there is actually a video of Prabhupada walking on Juhu Beach, and he's reading Krishna book, and the devotee's reading Krishna book, and they're just listening. So it's not like Prabhupada was into arguing. No. Prabhupada would sometimes argue with Mayavadis because they were directly offending Krishna. Now, one time Prabhupada was speaking to a priest and he was telling them, you shouldn't eat meat. Now, there's a difference between eating meat, which is a sinful activity, and impersonalism, which is denying Krishna's personal existence. And if you are a devotee, and you hear somebody denying Krishna's personal existence, you will say something, because it's very disturbing to you. You will deal with it. But if a person's committing sinful activity, you may point out that it's sinful, but it generally will not cause you to become upset or result in an argument. So we saw that with Prabhupada when he was speaking to a priest, and he was telling the priest that you should not kill animals for food. And of course, the priest didn't understand, and so the conversation was going back and forth. But Prabhupada never got upset with him. He was very patient. He was very kind and tolerant. But when someone was preaching Mayavad philosophy, yeah, then Prabhupada would be very upset. He would get fiery, because that's actually blasphemy. It's actually blasphemy to say Krishna is impersonal. So that's a little bit how Prabhupada dealt with people. If a person was offensive, or if a person was, there's a story. Prabhupada was a professor was having darshan. He was an Indian man, and he was a professor of Hinduism in America, and it took place in Philadelphia, I believe. So Prabhupada asked him, what is Hinduism? He's a Hindu professor, so he asked him, what is Hinduism? And the professor said something like, I don't know, or it's difficult to say. Or he just said, I don't know. So Prabhupada He would always say that if you're a teacher and you don't know, you're a cheater. So he really didn't like that when people were teaching and they didn't know what truth was and they were making it up. So he did something interesting to kind of chastise this professor. And Prabhupada turned to his disciple, Sri Ramdamodar, and said, Sri Ramdamodar, Mr. So-and-so, he's a professor of Hinduism, and he doesn't know what Hinduism is. He's teaching it, but he doesn't know what it is. What does that mean? What is that called? Or what is he? What is he? Sri Ramdamodar. And Sri Ramdamodar said, he's a cheater. And Prabhupada said something, he's calling you a cheater. Are you going to take that? So he just put the man on the spot as a technique of preaching. And the man became a little offensive. But actually they had to pull him out of the room. So sometimes when Prabhupada was dealing with people who were stubborn or obstinate and didn't want to learn, then he would become heavy. Some boy asked him a question about Guru, and then Prabhupada asked him a question, and he was trying to make a point about Guru, but first you have to surrender and listen. And the boy kept saying, I asked you first, and Prabhupada said, I asked you first. They got in an argument. It was a public program. Prabhupada was demonstrating how to accept a Guru submissively. So sometimes when people needed to be chastised, he would do it. But as far as being angry, it was usually because of impersonalists trying to deny Krishna's presence. His anger was out of love for Krishna. And I think his anger, we could also say, it was out of concern for the conditioned souls. They were being cheated. So it was, Prabhupada was very compassionate. And when you're very compassionate, it's difficult to tolerate when you know that people are being misled. And he was really concerned that science was misleading people, because science is atheistic. And the danger of science is that, you know, it's one thing to propound atheism, but it's another thing to do it in the name of science, because then it becomes more believable. So he was really concerned that in the name of science they were teaching atheism. No God, no soul. And of course Prabhupada came to teach there is God and soul, and thereby getting us out of the material world. And these people are teaching there's no God, no soul. That means we're going to be here in the material world forever if we follow them. So we were very, very concerned about that. And I wouldn't say angry in the sense we understand angry, but angry in the sense that they were misguiding people. So in one lecture, Prabhupada was talking about them, and he said, they are the greatest enemies of human civilization. Wow. Do you imagine being in that class? Scientists are the greatest enemies of human civilization. So Prabhupada had that vision. He saw that. He was really, really concerned, very concerned about it, out of his compassion. So sometimes you can get angry out of compassion. So we saw that. You know, Prabhupada's emotions were always in relation to how Krishna and his movement were being dealt with. So, do you have any questions? Any other comments? Otherwise, we'll end here. I don't. It's also interesting because Prabhupada could have like a debate with somebody. And at the end, he was just like, okay, let's take prasadam. You know, it was like, it was not like us. We have a debate with someone, our whole false ego's on the line now. Who's going to win this debate? Wasn't like that with Prabhupada. He'd make his point. Then the conversation was over. Okay, let's give him prasadam and light talk, and everything's fine. That's because he's not under the modes of nature. He's not acting, in that way. You know what I mean? Like, our false ego can sometimes get in the way. We want to win an argument. It wasn't like that with Prabhupada. But if somebody was teaching that Krishna is not God, the impersonal Brahman is God, somebody's teaching there's no God, or someone's teaching irreligion in the name of religion, then Prabhupada would be very upset, and he would let them know. So you have that aspect also. Okay. Anything else you want to say or ask or do? Yeah, listen to the morning walks. You'll like them. LA morning walks, really nice. Denver. The Indian morning walks, I don't like so much because Prabhupada's just debating with these people. And it's kind of, I don't know, you might like it. I just think they kind of ruin it, personally. But one day I drove from Alachua to New York, and all I did was listen to morning walks, one after the other. And by the time I got to New York, I was like so inspired. I felt like, I could become the next Martin Luther King and create a revolution. That was what it's like. Okay, so we'll talk to you later. Class, yeah, I think we can do class Tuesday night. We'll schedule that. If there's any problem, I'll let you know. Okay, hope you're all well. And we'll see you Tuesday night, Wednesday morning in India. Hare Krishna.